This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes in our midst. There are men and women right around you who've done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and many times inspired by these stories from our greatest generation.
Well, I got,
and I'm pretty sure that's going to be the case
today,
lumber
business,
because if you just met this man,
company, just
you'd be
two
impressed.
Miles north of Woodlake.
96 years old, doesn't look
mill,
like it, doesn't sound
box
like
factory.
It. And
dry kill.
I imagine you get that reaction sometime. Augustine Chavez of Visalia, California,
and
our
he told
guest.
Me, he says,
so, Augie, how often do you have
home,
people say, no, you're not 96 years old?
Quite
and
often.
I advanced pretty
do you have
much
a good line, a good comeback
the
for them when they ask you something like
that?
That
I had. You
yes,
know,
I tell them that I was obedient to my father and mother.
That's why the Lord blessed me with such a long
took
life.
Off right away.
I like that
and
answer.
And I became yard
well,
foreman.
Well, speaking of your father and mother, let's go back to your early days growing up in a neat part of the San Joaquin Valley, right up against the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, Woodlake, California. What was it like growing up in Woodlake? Contracted malaria overseas in the jungle, and then you had some recurrences of it here?
Poor, but there was a lot of family-like. We stuck together. We had a lot of cohesion, and we went to church, especially on Sundays. I went to Sunday school, and I got my first award when I was 7 years old in the Presbyterian Church for learning the names of the books of the Bible, Old and New Testament.
At 7 years old, I like that, in Woodlake, California. And we're going to find out about your World War II service in the 40th Infantry Division and the different things you experienced in the Pacific. But you mentioned the Depression years there in Woodlake. You had a couple brothers. You had three sisters. What'd you guys do to keep yourselves occupied out there? I imagine there were no shortage of adventures.
Well, after school, we had chores to do. No one had to tell us to gather wood and chop wood and milk a cow. I got half of the milk, raw milk, and ride horses and had a lot of good outdoor exercise. I herded cattle, at least 50 cows, two, three times a week for my brother-in-law, who was a cattleman and had a meat market and slaughterhouse and grazing cattle up in Dry Creek.
And at Woodlake High School, I know you were part of the class of 1936. Were you into sports at all? Was that a big deal? I know Woodlake years later had become famous for its football program with the great Leo Robinson out there, but were you an athlete in high school?
I never was physical enough to be an athlete in the big sports. However, under those conditions, I took up swimming and diving. And I became pretty expert at it.
And when you got done with high school in 1936, what ambitions did you have? Did you have a grand plan for what you were going to do in life?
Well, I had plans of getting my advanced education at home because everybody was poor in those days. But my advantage was that my greatest virtue was reading. I read since I was a little kid, and I read a lot, and God gave me the ability to retain a lot of what I read. With the strength of that, I'd done public speaking many times on economics, history, and music, the sound of the big bands and all that.
And people might figure out with your age at 96 that maybe you got into the service before America was drawn into World War II, and I know that is indeed the case. So how was it that you decided to join the Army?
Well, quite a few of my friends were in the National Guards, and I wanted to get a little excitement out of life because, like I say, everyone was so poor that we were lucky to get out to Larry County once in a while. So I joined the National Guards, and we went on maneuvers. We had our coat of arms even before war was declared and everything. And then henceforth, we trained draftees from Camp Roberts and Camp Walters, Texas.
I know you've got a pretty good story about where you were on December 7th and how you found out about all that, but take me back if you can. I know you've got a really good memory. So do you remember what you were thinking before that happened? Did you expect, do you think, war to break out? Were you kind of anticipating what was going to happen?
Well, I wasn't intellectually inclined at that time, but the handwriting was on the wall. You know, it first they said that the extension of the service and plus 6 months, but that didn't come true. And Of course, I was pretty young to have the perspective of advanced thinking like that. So when Pearl Harbor was bombed, I was in an extended weekend pass. So my dad woke me up and says, put your uniform on and head for San Luis Obispo.
So you're back here in Woodlake with your family, and your dad hears over the radio, and you got to get it in gear. Did that? How did that play out in your mind? Was that exciting? Did it make you a little nervous and concerned? What do you remember about that?
Well, it was an era of patriotism, and everybody wanted to do their duty. So consequently, I wasn't scared or anything. I knew that the Lord would have his right hand on me continuously, and I just took off. We loaded ammunition for 2 days and two nights, and then we headed for Los Angeles to set up installations around the coast.
And I've talked to a lot of folks who were at different parts of the California coast during that time, the immediate aftermath of the Pearl Harbor attack. And a lot of them have described the, I wouldn't call it panic, but great concern that Japanese planes and ships might be showing up on the California coast. Were you at all concerned about that? Did you catch any of that kind of buzz?
Well, in the books that I had read, I wasn't quite surprised because I studied Homer Lee, who was expelled from Stanford University at the turn of the 20th century for making statements like the possibility of Pearl Harbor being bombed 45 years before it happened. And on the strength of that, I was a little perturbed, but it did come really a surprise to me because when he wrote The Valor of Ignorance, this is just a marvelous book, he got expelled for making statements like the possibility of Pearl Harbor being bombed 40 years before it happened, and he was brokenhearted, so he went to China during the Boxer Rebellion and became the finest military strategist of that era. His teachings were compulsory in the Japanese, Russian, German army, optional at West Point.
Yeah, so you had a clue of what was going on in the world. Were you eager to get involved somewhere and to see America rise from those ashes of Pearl Harbor? Was that a little nerve-wracking for you to consider that possibility?
We didn't have time to think because things were happening so fast, you know, that we just didn't have time to worry about like that. We all were ready to do our duty, and we knew that it wasn't going to be fun, but we left it in God's hands.
And as it turned out, both of your brothers would end up in the service as well. Were you able to keep tabs on them during World War II?
A little bit. My one brother was in the hospital ship, made trips back and forth from France and England, bringing wounded. And my other brother was in finance. He had 2 years of college, so he went up pretty fast in the Air Force.
And let's talk about your experience. So you'd been in before the war, so you'd been through that toughen you up kind of period, the break you into the Army. How soon did you actually get deployed, and what can you share about your first taste of combat?
Well, when we left Los Angeles, we got extensive training in Fort Lewis, Washington for 4 months, and then we went to the Hawaiian Islands for 8 months and done jungle training and trained also recruits. We knew that sooner or later we were going to confront the enemy. So in August 1943, we relieved the 1st Marines in Guadalcanal, and that was our first taste of action.
And you don't just press a button and end up at Guadalcanal. You had some ocean to cover to get there. I'm just curious, as a boy who grew up in the San Joaquin Valley, had you ever been on a ship before? And what was that journey to Guadalcanal like for you?
The first time I was on a ship was 2,500 of us on the President Johnson, and we went to the Hawaiian Islands. It took us about 3 or 4 days to get there. Well, that was it. We trained. We were ready. We knew that we're going to confront the enemy sooner or later. And we didn't have time to worry about like that, things like that.
So this is with the 40th Infantry Division that you arrive at Guadalcanal. The Marines have been fighting there to secure that island. And what were your specific duties in your unit?
Well, my specific duties at that time, I was a corporal and I was squad leader. And my duties were to teach my my squad the intricate phases of the guns that we handled and the different fires and how to confront the enemy on certain situations. However, and then as I became a sergeant, I'd done quite a bit of lecturing in machine guns and the intricate phases of -21, -21-55, -21-100. But in the field of battle, there's no time to check the field manual. It's common sense, imagination, and guts, which was the American soldier has always been famous for, and you function on reflexes.
Well, I think you're whetting all of our appetites to hear some of the stories of where you had to do that. But as far as Guadalcanal was concerned, what greeted you when you got there? What are some of the images and situations that you can still remember all these years later?
Well, primarily there was no water, and the water finally that we got tasted like gasoline. It was raining cats and dogs. I mean, really raining hard. And the first few days we got some training for the front lines, and we knew that we were going to relieve the enemy real soon, and we were prepared for that. However, most of the fighting had already been done by the Marines, and we cleaned up.
And you say that you cleaned up, and you know what that means, and you lived it. But for those of us who weren't there, can you help us understand what that meant? And as a relatively young man, I mean, you're, I guess, 25 years old by this point, I imagine you were seeing things that you'd never seen before and that you didn't really want to see. Was it hard to kind of take in that destruction and devastation and the loss of life?
Well, you don't have time to worry about getting killed. Like I say, you function on reflexes, and you have a duty to do, and all you want to do is stay alive as much as you can and protect your squads and the men that you're in charge of. Well, that's it. We stayed there in Guadalcanal until we completely cleaned the island. In confronting the enemy, by that time they were on defense, and we were doing the advancing. And from there on, we got ready to another invasion in New Britain. We were the first troops there.
Well, I want to hear about that. And kind of a side note that I'm thinking of as we're discussing this. Now, your heritage is French and Spanish and Native American. I'm sure there are other soldiers who saw your last name, and they knew that you were some kind of minority, so to speak, that maybe they thought you were Mexican. I've talked to some Hispanic soldiers or Latino veterans who encountered some ribbing, or some of them have called it racist behavior that was employed against them. Did you ever have any kind of issues with any of the other soldiers that you served with, or how did they embrace you?
No prejudice at all. Predominantly, our replacements were from New York and the Midwest, and they were amazed, most of them, at the kind of English that we spoke. Of course, I was fortunate enough to, with the Mexican fellows of Mexican heritage that were in Company D, they came from families that always spoke English at home. And I was brought up in a town in Woodlake where there was no prejudice. And I was very fortunate. I went to Sunday school. I went with the Anglo kids, and they treated me just wonderful. Of course, I was a little vain, and I made up my mind, like my dad said, always study and rub elbows with people that know more than you do, because how can you edify yourself if you run around with people that know less than you do? And by the writings and the reading that I done and the knowledge that I acquired as a very young man, the Anglo kids were amazed that I knew more about things of our government than they did.
Well, I think anybody listening right now is getting an idea of how they felt. You mentioned New Britain. That's a long way from Great Britain. Tell us where New Britain was and what you were doing there.
Well, it was part of the British archipelago, you know, along with Guadalcanal, New Guinea, and all that. There was quite a few Japanese troops there, but not as many as we thought we would be. The resistance wasn't that great, but still many of us got killed. Our big resistance came when we were the first troops in the first wave in Luzon in the Philippines.
And we'll get to that. I'm curious, and you just made reference to people getting killed. Do you remember the first time that somebody you actually knew or had spent a lot of time with or had drawn close to was killed in action, and what that meant to you, how you responded to that?
Well, many of the fellows that I knew real well got killed. In fact, we were on the advance one time, and DG, we used to call him DG Geronimo, just about 20 feet from me, stepped on a mine, and his body just blew all every direction, and I just kept going. I didn't want to look back, but later on in my foxhole, I couldn't help but get the shakes. And many others that I wasn't very close to got killed, but it's quite an experience. It's no fun talking about it.
No, and I'm not trying to put you in a place that's not comfortable or that's painful, but it sure does help us to understand what you've been through, so we don't take things for granted. And I just hear you talking now, and you seem so comfortable and confident and sure of who you are. in those moments, I'm sure there are a lot of things that go through your mind. If you're in that foxhole and your buddies have been killed that day, whether it's by a sniper's bullet or a machine gun or a mine like that, isn't there part of you that says, that could be me tomorrow? And how do you deal with that?
Well, you, like I say, you function on reflex. There's no doubt that you can understand that you're scared, but you're not a coward, because your buddies are doing the same you're doing, and you want them to be proud of you, and they felt the same way afterwards when I speak to them, that that they were only up there because they had a lot of company.
That is a great point. The strength in numbers, that inspiration provided by others putting their lives on the line, and that's what Augie Chavez did in World War II. He's still going strong at 96. In fact, he still sings in a band, and I'm going to try to get him to sing for us before we're done. Time for a break, but we'll go back to the jungles of the Pacific with this veteran of the 40th Infantry Division and find out how he earned the Bronze Star. Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 96 years old, Augie Chavez of Visalia, California, originally from a few miles northeast of there in Woodlake. We've heard about how he ended up in the 40th Infantry Division, enlisting before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. He's shared some of his experiences as a squad leader in a heavy weapons platoon, employing water-cooled 30-caliber machine guns as well as Browning automatic rifles. His first taste of action was at Guadalcanal, where the 40th replaced the 1st Marine Division, but he would find himself on the front lines in places like New Britain and several islands in the Philippines, starting with Luzon in January of 1945.
We were the first wave in Luzon, and on our left was the AmeriCal Division from Washington, and on our right was 25th Division Regular Army. And the Raiders, their job was to release the prisoners. Our job was to take the island. And we suffered quite a bit in Luzon because we ran out of water. And after a while, when our tongues were getting thick, well, they dropped water with small Lister bags. Then after they got to our destination, well, we still had to wait about 20 minutes for the chlorine to be put in, and that was an eternity.
Yeah, and you described that like it's no big deal, that that's just kind of a matter-of-fact thing that you went through. But I want people to understand this and feel this. You're out there fighting an enemy that wants to kill you and destroy you, and you don't even have water to survive on. It seems to me that that's pretty frightening, pretty desperate, pretty devastating. What was it that helped you get through that and believe that you could get through it?
Well, you know, you can go a long time without food, because our supply lines one time in New Guinea were cut off for 2 weeks, but you can't go very long without water. And it's so wonderful to get that drink of water. Like I say, everybody had a job to do as an area of patriotism, and whether you got killed or not, well, you knew that you were doing your duty for your country, and you wanted your country when you got home, if you were fortunate enough, to be proud of you. So I had some very tough experiences. I don't know why I'm still alive, but I've seen guys killed right by me, blowed up 20 feet from me, and I'm still here. So in reference to that, well, I'm always expounding the word of salvation to the public, because at least the Lord brought me home in good shape. And I want to give him back what he deserves. Because the Word of God says the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. He that winneth souls is wise.
Well, and I know you've got a story that can get people's attention when you tell it. And I'm curious, because you shared not only how much education you had before you went over there, but how much you had invested in your spiritual life and in your faith. So I guess the question is, while you were over there, was there something specific, whether it was from reading your Bible or something that your parents or someone else had shared with you that was meaningful to you and helped you believe that as bad as this was, you were going to come home someday?
Well, yes, I was very fortunate to come back because so many of our buddies, especially in our campaign of Negros, 68 days without a bath. Of course, we went a couple of times through creeks and soaked our fatigues and all that, but we didn't have a bath for 68 days, and a lot of us got killed because the enemy was very well established, you know, and we were making the invasion. So I just looked forward that if I ever got out alive, you know, I would always expand the things that made America great. And it really hurts me in this day and age that our government is caving in so rapidly through government subsidy and immorality. And at one time we were envied by every country in the world, and today we are hated by everybody. I'll give you a little example. My sub-nephew, who's dad was my best friend. We were in the service together. It worked out so good. When he came home, he married my niece, Rosie Marsh. His name was Frank Marsh. And his son says, Augie, why don't you tell my daughters about when the Imperial Marines invaded you? Well, I said three words, and then I got emotional. I couldn't do it. But they understood. But anyway, it wasn't fun. And the mode of existence was not conducive to longevity, not only because the enemy shoots back at you, but food, you know, and water and all that, and your dirty clothes all the time, can't get a haircut. But when you come back, you really hate to discuss these things because they're not fun. But thank God that America is still, there's still a chance to survive. Like the Bible says, if you look up, my people that call by my name should look up and humble themselves and pray to God, I will heal their land. But you can't find people today that will expand the word of God. They're ashamed.
Well, I know you're not ashamed. And just picking up on a few of the things you said there, you mentioned on Negros, 68 days without a bath. What happens to you when you go that long without a bath? Can you paint a picture for us of what you felt like, what the morale of your unit was, and maybe lead us up to that point where you finally did get to end that drought after 68 days?
It's hard to explain it because you get so disgusted, you know, you're so dirty and everything that, but when the time came to get relieved, the first thing you looked forward to was to take a bath and wash your hair with soap, of course, no shampoo. And you know that things are going to be better because, well, you've done your job and you've been told that you're going home right after this campaign. And in view of the fact that I had 105 points accumulated, you only needed 85 to get discharged. And the reason, because I was in before Pearl Harbor and I had five campaigns. So I knew that by the grace of God, I was going to come back to America and enjoy life with my relatives and my brothers and sisters, dad and mom, and so forth. I was very fortunate to have a very godly mother, you know, that always had a lot of faith in God, and she always said, my three sons are coming back, and we did.
Yeah, thanks, Mom, for all those prayers. You mentioned the Imperial Marines, these guys that you were fighting against, and I know, you know, so many veterans have shared with me that there was plenty of passion, there was plenty of emotion, there was plenty of motivation to go defeat this enemy. But being so intimately involved with that enemy for as long as you were, what impression did you end up forming of those guys that were fighting for their country, fighting for Japan?
Well, we were in New Britain. No, this was Panay. And I guess the Imperial Marines thought that they were already taken the island. And right before daylight, they attacked us. They didn't know that our perimeter was right around where they were coming from. But they were the cream of the crop. These guys were big and tough, and and very good height. They were the cream of the crop of Japan, the Imperial Marines. And when we heard the noise, you know, in Japanese talk when they were approaching, well, we threw two flares up and they were exposed right there, and we had machine guns facing right in there. So there was a lot of dead people the next day, and it was really, really something sad to see, and glad that we had defeated them, and also glad that our casualties were at a minimum because we caught them by surprise.
And you mentioned machine guns. You had a lot of experience with the machine guns. You were actually in charge of a heavy weapons platoon, or how many guys did you have serving under you?
In a squad, you have 12, six to each squad. And we had 50 caliber machines, but they were the 4th platoon, and 81 millimeter mortars, which was the 4th platoon. The three platoons in a heavy weapons company are machine guns. And when we get into really actual action, well, each platoon is attached to a rifle company to supply overhead fire. Well, you do the things over and over and over again, because when you get into rest area, you still have to keep training, and it's a repetition of the same thing. But like I said before, you have to learn all these things, because in the field of battle, in actual conditions, there's no time to check the manual. It's common sense, imagine, and guts. And you function on reflex. You know exactly what to do. You've had so much training.
When it comes to those guts, where did that come from for you? How did you develop those kind of guts?
Well, I guess by being brave men on your right and left, and doing the things that you got to do, it gives you that extra courage, you know. And you know that you have a job to do, and if it's your time to go, praise God. You know that you're going to heaven, because in my case, I was brought up in a Christian family, and I felt sorry a lot for those men that never spoke about salvation and all that. It was foolishness to them. All the time, I never hesitated to mention the Word of God, and maybe that's a good reason why the Lord still has me alive here.
And as far as the machine guns that you operated, obviously there's an advantage to having a machine gun. You can pump out a lot of lead in a short time, but it occurs to me there's a disadvantage too, because aren't you one of the biggest targets the enemies want to take out if you're the one with that machine gun? And how did that bear itself out in battle?
You're right. Well, very vulnerable, the machine guns, because you can kill so many people, you know. A section of machine guns is crossed, and then the fire comes, they cross each other like that, and it doesn't reach the height of a man. It doesn't reach the height of a man, the trajectory, so you know you're going to kill a lot of people, and that's why they're after you. I was just fortunate that the Lord got me through.
And I know that it takes some skill. Was there one aspect of operating those machine guns that, when you think back on it, was the most crucial or the most helpful to understand, that maybe you developed over time, that I wouldn't say a trick to it, but a skill that you had to develop?
Well, the important thing is that your men got to know that they have to have asbestos gloves when you move the machine guns to another position, because if you ever touch that barrel, hey, man, you'd cook your hands, you know. Your hands would really be scorched. So it's things that you got to function automatically without even thinking about it, because you've trained so much. It's a tough job, but you got to do it, and that's the way it is.
And I've got to ask you, since you brought that up about wearing the gloves, is that something you learned the hard way, or someone else paid the dumb tax on that one for you?
Well, you learn all this before actual conditions when the barrel is cold. But then when you're out training, you know, and exemplifying actual conditions, the first thing you do is you put the gloves on you. The men know that if they touch that barrel, gee whiz, it's just going to cook their hands, scorch them.
I know you mentioned a few minutes ago seeing guys killed right next to you. When you think back on it, you've stated a couple times that you believe God brought you home. Are there some times that stick out in your mind as moments where He had His work cut out to get you out of there, and that something that you would remember as a close call?
Well, when one gets killed, automatically the next man behind that brings ammunition takes over, and that's the way it's trained out. And even the leader has to handle a machine gun in actual conditions, because sometimes a guy's wounded, or sometimes he's back there bringing ammunition, and those guns got to keep going. You know, you got to supply that overhead fire so the rifleman can advance.
What would you say is the moment, and I know there were a lot of moments, but maybe the one incident that strikes you as the closest you came to being a casualty?
I had my squad set up in a Japanese garden, I guess. It was in a little town, just a little hick town. There was a marker, you know, a grave marker there, and I just laid my head down, and just about the time I laid my head down on the cemetery plaque, the bullet hit the, just almost grazed me, you know. That's the closest. And there are other times when there's bombs and machine gun fire from the enemy and all that I wonder sometimes why I came alive, because I had some real close calls. The Lord can get you out of the lion's den or anything else. He done it through the Bible if he wants to. There's nothing impossible to God. Why some get killed and some don't? Well, I cannot answer that question.
And just to clarify for everybody listening, you talk about that close call you just described. That bullet sailed right past your temple, like within an inch or so?
I'm laying down on the marker, and the bullet hit about right there. I was going to rest, you know, and lay down, and there was a garden there, and there was cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers and things. And I was looking forward to eating a cucumber. And I did eat a cucumber that night, but, it was really a tough night because I came so close.
And when you say close, you're talking inches.
Yes, I'm talking about staying alive, you know. When you're advancing, the enemy is set up to kill you, you know, when you're advancing. You know, they're set up pretty well. It's tough.
Now, I know among your decorations for your service with that 40th Infantry Division, you were awarded the Bronze Star for valor. What can you tell us? I know you don't want to pat yourself on the back, and you're not looking for attention, but I think it's important for us to understand not just what you did, but what the other guys around you did. And your story is an example of what so many Americans did, whether they were looking for attention or not. So how much can you tell us about the incident that earned you that Bronze Star?
Well, we was going through a small town in the Philippines in Panay, and I was on the front, you know, reconnaissance. When you go through a building, you know, you don't know what's in there. You expose yourself. So when I kicked the door open, there was a young Japanese soldier there, and, I had to kill him. And afterwards, when I looked at him, he didn't look a day over 18. Of course, you know, Japanese don't show their age like a lot of us don't. And I thought, gee, why did I kill this guy? He never done anything to me or anything. But that's the way we're brought up in Americanism, you know. Even though you kill a guy, you wonder, why did you kill him? He never really done anything wrong to me, but it's your job. You got a job to do. I guess that's one time when the Lord knows that you have a job to do and there's nothing you can do. You got to serve your country. So that's, I guess, when killing is justified, I guess.
Well, and I'm guessing that if they gave you the Bronze Star for it, that the implication was by taking him out and taking that position that you may have saved some other Americans' lives or at least helped achieve a strategic advance?
Yes, absolutely. That's what it is, to save as many lives as you can. Because if you're wounded, you're more of a problem to your comrades than it is if you get killed. Because to get wounded, it takes other people to take care of you and so forth and everything and get you out of the situation.
That's another good point. We haven't discussed all that much on this show over the years. And there's much more to discuss with 96-year-old Augie Chavez, including the time he was literally paralyzed by fear, as well as moments where the joy was enough to make you sing. And we'll hear him sing before we're done. I promise. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, spending the hour today with 96-year-old Augie Chavez of Visalia, California. While visiting him at the Walnut Park Senior Living Community there, I got him an application for honor flight, so hopefully he's going to be headed to Washington, D.C. soon to see the National World War II Memorial. And wherever you're listening today, there is an honor flight hub near you, so I hope that you'll tell all the World War II veterans in your life about this opportunity for a trip of a lifetime that's absolutely free for them. Where I live here in Central California, it was really exciting to announce this past week that Central Valley Honor Flight will add another flight of 75 World War II veterans taking off in October from the historic runway at what used to be Castle Air Force Base in Atwater. We're about 2 months away from that, so if you'd like to help in the effort, let me know. Just email me, paul@hometownheroesradio.com. HometownHeroesRadio.com is where you can find more info about Mr. Chavez and see some photos of this amazing 96-year-old. Let's get back to his story now. Five campaigns in the Pacific. So many of your friends were wounded or even killed, but you were never wounded. Is that hard for you to believe? Because you certainly beat the odds, didn't you?
Oh, yes, very much. Not even get wounded, because I've seen guys wounded two or three times. The man that married my niece when we came home, he was wounded. One time I asked him, I says, Frank, I says, you know, the reason why I kept going all the time is because I didn't want you to think I was a coward. He says, well, how do you think I felt?
All those places that you were, and I know you were fighting for your country, but I'm sure it occurred to you at some point that these islands that you're fighting on, there are people there whose freedom was at stake also. Did you ever have much of a chance to interact with the native inhabitants of any of those islands or the Filipinos when you got to places like Panay and Luzon?
Very much. Anytime we went through a town, you know, I'd see a little girl or a little boy, and instead of consuming my chocolate bar, you know, I'd give it to him or give him an apple or whatever I had, you know, because I felt sorry for him. And they were very grateful. They were grateful. The Filipinos treated us very royally. We were very fortunate in the Philippines, even though my wish would have been to go into Europe. But, well, things were planned different. So I wandered out in the Pacific for 3 years.
Why was it that you would have preferred Europe?
More sophisticated countries, you know, and more things to see in the cities and all that. Whereas what could you do in the jungles most of the time in the islands? It was always one island after another, the same thing.
What's the worst thing you ever ate or out of desperation had to choose to eat in all those years fighting in these jungles?
Well, I would say old C rations and K rations. And one time when our supply lines got cut off in New Guinea, 2 weeks, well, each one had one can of salmon in their pack. And we ate a couple of bites of that each day, once a day, to survive. And then finally, when the mess trucks came by the time I got there, the cream of wheat was cold, the powder eggs were cold, the dehydrated potatoes were cold, and the pancakes were cold, and that's the best meal I've ever had in my life.
It's all about perspective, isn't it? And you certainly had a different one there. How often did you hear from home, and what did it mean to you when you did?
I was very fortunate. My niece, Rosie, who married my best friend, Frank Marsh, she sent me a lot of packages, and she sent me music magazines, and then I made quite a few friends in British Columbia on weekends when I'd go from Fort Lewis, and all those girls would always send me magazines that I liked of music and cookies and so forth. And oh, I got so much attention from everybody that I felt sorry for the guys that didn't get much attention from home. And whenever I got a package with goodies like sardines and canned tamales and enchiladas and all that, which they were a lot different than the real stuff, I always shared them. We always got together and shared it with each other.
Well, I'm sure they liked having you around then. I know some of these questions aren't easy to answer and they're not fun to talk about, but you shared what you think your closest call was. And maybe it's the same answer on this one, maybe not. If you think back through all those experiences, was there one time where you think you were the most frightened, the most scared, or the most concerned that you might not make it back to Woodlake?
When we first landed in Luzon, we were the first wave. I was carrying a tripod, and when I hit the beach for about 8 or 10 seconds, my legs wouldn't function. I froze because all the heavy fire from the Navy that was ahead of us, so we could advance, you know. I don't know why, but my legs wouldn't move. But after a while, I justified myself, and I'd done real well.
What do you think it was that finally kicked in for you that freed you from that paralysis?
Justification of the situation. You knew that you had to go forward, and you saw your buddies going forward, so you gave yourself courage.
Do you remember where you were when you found out that Japan had surrendered?
I was at home with a bad case of malaria. Otherwise, I'd have been in San Francisco celebrating, because, boy, they had a celebration in San Francisco. But anyway, that's where I was, because they surrendered about 3 months after I was discharged.
Well, let's talk about that first, then. Getting that news that you were going to get to come home.
It was such a rejoicing in your heart, because you didn't think you'd come back, you know. When we went overseas, we knew that the world was in its embryonic stages, and we were on the advance. The enemy was already situated in every island that we took, every place we went, they were set up good, you know. I didn't think that I'd come back, but when I did find out that I was coming home, it was hard to believe. It was a realistic situation that you didn't expect.
And you mentioned malaria, obviously something you got fighting in the jungles there. But like so many other Pacific veterans, it was something you dealt with long after you came home, right?
I would get probably sick about every 3 or 4 months. I'd have a relapse. It took about 2 years to get rid of it. And finally, Dr. Milligan, he says, I'm not going to charge you, but I'm going to experiment on you. And he done the best job for me, and I got rid of it. And here I am, 96 years old, and I'm still able to. I have my mind, and I have my voice. But other than that, there's a few things that are coming apart.
Well, you could have fooled me. So you're back home, you endure that malaria until the doctor helps you get over it. But what about that news that Japan surrendered? You're here, you didn't get to celebrate in San Francisco, but what did it mean to you? Because you'd been there for so much of it, and you'd seen so many of your friends that weren't coming home. What did it mean to you to find out that this war is over and that your side had won?
Well, a lot of the replacements that came, you know, I knew that they would be coming home, and they wouldn't have any more fighting to do. And that was quite a relief. And after 2 weeks, it was kind of lonesome in Wood Lake, because I was the first one that got discharged from the town. And I just missed my buddies, my acquaintances, that we developed such a close friendship, you know, with certain fellas in the service that you miss them. And I miss those fellows, but then you got adjusted, and life's been good to me. I thank God for bringing me back. I have experiences. The only time I discuss them is like you here interviewing me, and I'm glad that sometimes I might have been incoherent, but it was unprepared. You realize that?
I don't think anyone listening is going to call you incoherent. I think they're pretty amazed that you're as sharp as you are. 96 or 26. And since you are so sharp, maybe I should ask you this, because I think you have an understanding. You know what the 40th Infantry Division did. You know what your squad did. And you know what America did during that time. So when you think about that, so many of us weren't alive then, didn't experience it. What's important for us to know? What do we need to know about what you all did and why you did it?
Well, like I said in my first and start of an interview, it was an era of patriotism. But today there's been so many scrimmages, and, well, as an example, it's a deep subject, but I'll just go through it briefly in a few words. The United Nations was put together to create peace in the world. And yet right after that we had Korea, and then Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq. And it's the worst thing that ever happened to our country, or the forming of the United Nations, because that means world government, and that's against the word of God. And like I say, it's a deep subject. I've been a thorough study of it. I could make a speech on it, like I've done several times in different clubs. And I can only scratch the surface briefly, but our country's in trouble, and there's not enough patriotism. People wave a flag and a decal, but it's just like the boy that liked the game of football so well, but he didn't go out for the team because he hated to get his uniform dirty. You got to constantly keep fighting for freedom, because the forces of evil take two steps forwards and then one step backwards. And then when you take one step backward, well, you think you're winning, but you're not, because they were already taking two steps forward, one ahead of you. And our country's in real trouble. And the only thing that can save us now is the Lord, because, well, like I say, there's no patriotism and there's no spiritual discernment anymore. People don't, they think that salvation and the word of God is foolishness. And it is to them that perish. So we're in trouble.
A lot of times, the veterans that I interview, they kind of bristle at the name of this program, Hometown Heroes, because they say, hey, I'm not a hero. I was just doing what I was asked to do. But when you think about World War II and how you experienced it, are there guys that you remember as heroes in your mind?
The Hustis brothers in my company. Boy, they had a lot of valor. They were good men up front. They knew how to handle their platoons and all that. And, of course, I had a lot of good training from local guys like Sergeant Darcy, Sergeant Lee Cree. These guys knew the manual inside out. They'd make these second lieutenants for Fort Benning, Georgia, look sick with their knowledge. And I was always a good listener. The word got around that I knew a little bit, and I'm not boasting about it, but more than one officer told me that I was a very good speaker in analyzing the intricate phases of machine guns and rifles and all that. And maybe you might say I was a little vain, but I always took satisfaction in knowing something that most is dull to most other people. Instead of reading comics and so forth, I read economics, history. I think the history of my life is very important because I'm sort of self-made. I never had a formal education. But I was a deep thinker. My dad was well-educated in Spanish, and he always gave me good advice. He always took his hat off when the flag went by, and I grew with that heritage. I love my country, but I've been criticized because people tell me, oh, you hate America. I says, no, I dislike the people that are running it.
Anytime I interview someone who's your age, who's in the kind of shape and mental shape that you're in, I've got to ask you, what's your secret? What keeps you so young and so sharp? Is there something that you do that you can give the credit to?
Well, I'll be a little facetious. I told people I eat beans and tortillas, and they say, oh, no, you must eat something else. I never was a big eater, and I never was a boozer. Oh, I enjoy a cocktail and a beer, but I never was a smoker. So anyway, I had good heritage, even though we were poor, but we work hard. And hey, I have no regrets. I'm living in the greatest country in the world still. It's decaying rapidly, but we're still the best.
I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story, specifically with regard to the 40th Infantry Division. Is there something that you guys did over there that gives you great pride?
Well, I think so, because we took the island of Luzon. That was the biggest job we had. Of course, Negros was the time element that was so bad because we didn't have any facilities for 68 days. But I think Luzon would be the best because we had to work real hard and fight real hard and to get the enemy at the last out of the caves and so forth. It was tough. I think that Luzon was our biggest accomplishment.
So that was 70 years ago. As for today, tell me about Charlie and Friends. This is your five-piece band. You're the lead singer.
We play at different rest homes, like Quail, is where all the rich guys live. And we play here twice a month and once in a while at a wedding or reception. And I do the ad-libbing because I have a very good knowledge of the big bands, all the ballrooms and everything. And they say I still have a good voice. I don't know if that's true or not. We'll play anywhere for very little money. We do it just because we like to stay alive in our old age and still be able to entertain people. I like music very much. I like spiritual music. I sing in my church.
That's Faith Baptist Church in Visalia, if you want to catch them. But I know not all the people listening right now can catch you in person. And I said I'd try to have you sing for us. So I know it's a cappella, but what can you do for us here?
This is a number that I serenaded my wife on our 50th wedding anniversary. It's one of the last mementos of Frank Sinatra before he left the Tommy Dorsey band and took a solo flight into the world of wax. It was just a neighborhood dance, that's all that it was, but oh, what it seemed to be. It was like a masquerade ball with costumes and all. 'Cause you were at the dance with me. It was just a ride on a train, that's all that it was, but oh, what it seemed to be. It was like a trip to the stars, to Venus and Mars, 'cause you were at the train with me. And when I kiss you, darling, it was more than just a thrill for me. It was a promise, darling, of the things that fate had willed for me. It was just a wedding in June
That's all that it was, but oh, what it seemed to be. It was like a royal affair with everyone there, 'cause you said, yes, I do, to me.
How about that? I'm sure Nelly loved that on your 50th anniversary. Maybe Charlie and Friends is going to have some more bookings after that performance. Augustine Chavez, 96 years old, a man of strong convictions. And some of those convictions wouldn't quite fit into the time we have here on the radio. That bonus material is included in the podcast at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.